Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with Episode 82 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Blake Rowe, the CEO, Speaks, about my conversation with the Chief Executive Officer of the Oregon Wheat Commission and the Oregon Wheat Growers League. Rowe has a nice way of putting things, such as the moment when one timber company, merging with another timber company, resulted in his being invited to entertain a career change. But the timber industry's loss is the wheat industry's gain. 7 years ago, when he took the Oregon wheat job, Rowe brought a new way of looking at agricultural issues with him. It wasn't just because he was an outsider. I think it helps that in addition to his forestry degree, he has a master's degree in economics and policy, with an emphasis on timber, from the University of Minnesota. I don't know if I've ever met anyone with a degree in policy, and when he told me, it made perfect sense. Rowe comes at an issue from a very particular point of view, based on what he knows about policy, which is a lot more than most of us. Although he was born in California, Rowe grew up in Springfield, Oregon for many years and went to Oregon State University. After the University of Minnesota, he worked for a consulting company and then a number of different timber companies with increasing responsibility. He wound up running the timber department for Longview Fiber, a company that was swallowed by the Canadian firm, and he was invited to leave. Like I said, the timber industry's loss has been the wheat industry's gain. You see, I'm all for synergy that comes from hybridization, whether we're talking about a wheat plant or a person. Rowe brings a set of skills and a way of turning a problem around in his hands that few people possess. And what a nice guy. Now, if you saw him standing on a street corner, you might keep your distance. He has a face that can look, well, cloudy. But the opposite is also true, and when he laughs, he lights up. I wrote a story in the magazine Wheat Life a few years ago about Rowe's handling of the spring 2013 fallout from the discovery of GMO wheat plants in an Oregon field. There couldn't have been a better person in my mind to field the dozens of media calls that came into him over a period stretching into weeks. The guy's unflappable. I visited Rowe at his office in the Wheat Marketing Center building in Portland on June 15, 2018. It's a wonderful space, rivaling, I think, the Washington Grain Commission's office. The boardroom where Rowe and I talked has a view out a long row of windows looking at the Broadway Bridge, a reddish-colored steel structure across the Willamette River. It has steep steel stairs people can take from below to reach bridge level. I tell you this because I was facing the window during my conversation with Rowe, and as we talked, a photographer and a young woman in what may be the skimpiest swimsuit I've seen outside of a Sports Illustrated swimsuit edition set up on the stairs not 30 feet away to shoot a few photos. I wasn't sure of the etiquette of the moment, and I continued with a few questions as the woman posed voluptuously. Ultimately, however, I suggested Rowe might want to turn around. He surveyed the scene, laughed, and said, "Another day in downtown Portland." I began our interview by asking Rowe what he has learned about the wheat industry during his seven-year tenure as CEO of the Wheat Commission and the Growers Organization.
One of them is I realize how much more important a social license is maybe than I did on the forestry side.
And what does that mean, the social license?
You know, I guess what it means is the general population doesn't understand us, but, you know, when you talk about the direction that politicians get from voters, if the general population doesn't have a high level of trust, they don't have a good working understanding of what agriculture does, what the science is, that's a red flag. We're going to have trouble when the general population doesn't have a high level of trust. And I think that's kind of where we're at right now. We face more calls for regulation. There's a comfort level that natural resource managers, land managers can be trusted to do good things, but only as long as we have agencies and outside groups scrutinizing their work. And we've never really been in that position before. That's kind of grown over the last 20, 25 years where we need there's a perspective that we need to be watched. We can't be trusted. You'll manage the land, but only if we have the right agencies and rules and oversight, with people that we actually trust to make sure that you're doing it right. That's different. We've gone through decades and decades where farmers, foresters, they were just generally trusted to do the right thing. It's not quite that way anymore. And that's, I guess, an indication that we've lost a little of our social license.
Are there any commonalities between timber and agriculture?
Actually, there are. There are quite a few. Many of the same regulatory issues that we wrestle with in the environmental arena, the use of pesticide products, water quality, all of those are they're pretty much common between the two entities. Sometimes the specifics of the application may vary, but in principle, they're very similar. There are some significant differences. Obviously, the first one's the crop. No one gets too attached to a wheat crop because it's there every year and gone. You grow a rotation of trees for 35, 40, 50 years, and the population, the neighbors that see you prepare to harvest those trees, they don't remember when it was last harvested. And they get very attached. That's one of the issues forestry wrestles with is neighbors, they don't like clear cuts. They don't want to see those trees gone. Even though they don't own them, they develop a sense of ownership to how their views look and how the property looks. And that's something the forestry wrestles with that we don't really see in wheat because we change the appearance, several times a year almost. Mm-hmm. And so our neighbors don't get quite as attached to the crop as they do in the timber side.
I did some homework, and I went back and I looked at some Oregon wheat magazines. And in one of the magazines recently, you referenced the potential lost jobs that could come as a result of the TPP without the U.S. And I guess when I read that, I thought, well, what about lost farmers? Do you think the trade snafus have the potential to further fuel the consolidation among wheat farmers?
Absolutely, and I guess I realize, in hindsight, I sort of lumped in the loss of farmers as one of the categories of jobs. But really, that's maybe it does a disservice because it does. Anything that affects our competitiveness risks the loss of farms. You never know who I'll call them marginal producers, but there's always a line there where if a farm can't compete consistently year over year, that farm's at risk. So, I think we do run the risk of losing farmers. I think it contributes to the you have to get bigger to survive. So economies of scale, more technology, more equipment, those things all drive farms to consolidate, get bigger, get more efficient. And that kind of runs counter to what the public wants. They don't realize it, but public wants smaller. They don't necessarily like big ag, but many of the things that the policies and regulations they put in place drive us to be bigger. It's an interesting sort of counterintuitive. They want one thing, but then they regulate us to get the opposite.
Should we be concerned that there would be fewer farmers?
I guess I'm not sure I have a good answer for that. From the standpoint of our ability to produce, no. From the standpoint of the number of people, your influence in your communities in the legislature does tie somewhat to the number of people who are involved in your industry. So as you get smaller, it doesn't necessarily mean you can't provide the product that people want, but you run the risk of your influence declining as the number of people involved in the economic effort declines.
So in that same column that I referenced earlier, you said Oregon won't give up a market without a fight. What does that fight look like?
I wish there was maybe more things we could do on trade policy, but basically you have to engage everywhere you can. You engage with your customers. They need to know that they matter. So we need to spend a little bit more time reassuring them that we're trying to address trade policy issues that work to their disadvantage. engage with the legislature, engage with the media, engage with the administration. We put together, can't tell you how many letters have gone to the administration about some of the trade policy issues. You know, whatever the venue is, wherever you think you might bring influence to the table, that's what that means. Don't skip any of them. They're all important, and I think we've done a decent job, even though we haven't necessarily impacted the policy, but that doesn't mean we're not trying. And customers need to know we're trying. So do our growers.
Absolutely. I spoke with an economist recently who suggested that soft white wheat may not be treated as harshly as other classes in Japan in terms of the TPP because there just isn't a replacement for soft white. What do you think?
I think it's partly correct. So I kind of think about that one from two directions. So one is soft white brings value to a customer. That's why they pick it. And to a certain point, as long as they perceive that soft white brings them more value than the change in the tariffs, so essentially our wheat's getting relatively more expensive, as long as the value calculation is still there, I think customers will continue to select soft white. Now, that's different for every customer. So some customers, that margin of the value brought by soft white could be relatively small, and that impact, you know, customers changing supplies, adjusting their operations to other kinds of wheat, that might happen sooner. So we're about to, you know, we're sort of embarked on a giant research project to see what that sensitivity is amongst our customers. But the flip side that we haven't talked about much is, let's just say that in a perfect world, we don't lose any customers. So we find out our wheat is so valuable that our customers will pay $65 more a ton effectively for soft white. Well, guess what? That's a signal to every other producer in the world that there's $65 premium if they can figure out how to grow soft white. Now, right now, most of them don't. But you put $65 margin on the table, and we might find out there is competition for producing soft white elsewhere in the world. So that's the other side of the coin here. I mean, I hope we'll be successful, but at some point, how's that old saying about excess profit breeds ruinous competition? Well, we might find out that if our customers really are so dedicated, they'll pay up. We may find we have more competition elsewhere in the world.
Washington and Idaho certainly recognize the importance of the Japanese market, but it was really Oregon that actually pioneered the Japanese market. Does the turmoil around TPP, tariffs, etc., impact Oregon farmers differently, perhaps more personally, or are we just simply all in the same boat?
Both statements are right. I don't think TPP really affects us differently than growers in Washington or Idaho, certainly from the standpoint of soft white and tariff impacts into Japan. We're in the same boat. But that said, our growers do see that market as somewhat personally. They were the first ones to go, and they have a kind of proprietary perspective that kind of goes back to the, you know, we'll do whatever it takes to defend that market. They do see that one a little bit differently. All markets are valuable, but they're a little possessive of that one.
Yeah, absolutely. You referred to the trade dilemmas we're facing as our wildest nightmare. Is there a bigger nightmare than finding genetically engineered wheat in an Oregon field?
Yeah, I don't. That's probably something that I wrote. I do see them a little bit differently. Even though the GE wheat issue was, certainly was a huge issue, I'd say we had a sense that we had a little more control over that. We could work directly with the agencies like APHIS. We could talk directly with our customers. We could work directly with U.S. Wheat. We had a better sense of control. When you get into the trade policy arena, you know, we kind of touched on that. I don't think we have the feeling that we have the same control. I mean, we could do everything right, and the policy will still be implemented as outlined by the Trump administration, and we're at risk of losing that market. So I think, you know, they're very different events, but what colors it in my mind is I think we had a more tangible way to address GE wheat, and when you get in the policy arena with trade policy, it's a harder thing to get your arms wrapped around the fix. And frankly, we won't fix it by ourselves. We didn't fix GE wheat by ourselves, but still, it's a different feel.
Yeah. So what do you think? Did the trade imbalances in the world create a situation where a correction, such as Trump is trying to orchestrate, was made necessary? Or do you think that we're experiencing a bull in the China shop moment?
I don't have a good answer for that one. Fundamentally, a trade imbalance, you can't run a huge trade imbalance indefinitely. It's not sustainable. We've run a trade imbalance for a long time. So at some point, just like deficit spending, at some point you have to address it. President Trump has in mind that it's going to be addressed, and it's going to be addressed on his watch and right now. And it's the shock or the abruptness of it that that's my answer. I think he perceives that this is a problem that needs to be addressed now. And philosophically, I might say, well, yeah, I know intuitively it's not sustainable forever, but it is a shock to try and do a kind of a 180 on how we handle imbalances in international trade.
You spend a lot of time doing customer service because you're here in Portland. You see a lot of trade teams. How important is customer service when it comes to the wheat industry? I mean, these countries need the wheat in any case.
You are correct, but when when you don't necessarily sell the cheapest wheat around, you're trying to persuade, demonstrate to the customer that there's a value proposition. There is a reason they should pay a little bit more for the product that we sell. And some of it goes back to the quality message. It's a high-quality wheat. It's consistent. They can rely. Well, we have a little trade policy issues here, but they can rely on us as a supplier. They don't have to worry about interruptions. We have good supply chain. We have good infrastructure. So all those things are part of customer service. It's not just, do we have the cheapest wheat?
The Philippines is an incredibly important U.S. market. They're either number one or two for soft white. And although the market doesn't appear to be threatened at this time, I'm just curious, do you see anything on the horizon you're concerned about with regard to the Philippine market?
So a couple things. First, we have, not only is it a very good market for us, but we enjoy a very high market share in the Philippines. So while you could look at that and say it might be difficult to increase our market share, there are plenty of opportunities for others to look at that and want to take some of our market share. So there are other suppliers of wheat, the Black Sea, Australia, Russia. There are plenty of folks who would be happy to sell into that market and certainly will challenge us. In the Philippines, we have actually worked on the subsidized flour issue with supplies of flour coming from Turkey and others who appear to subsidize their flour production and try to sell flour very cheap. In some cases, they could sell flour cheaper into the Philippines than Filipinos could produce it in the Philippines, which just defies logic. So, yeah, there are some risks there. Competitors always have competitors to pay attention to, and sometimes competition is not wheat, it's flour.
The three Pacific Northwest states, Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, went together to help fund a Latin American milling specialist. What do you hope to accomplish?
This is much the same pattern we've followed in many other countries in the Pacific Rim. It's not just making the customer aware that they can buy our wheat. It's also making them aware of the value proposition. And, particularly if you're an operating miller, that's in the routine course of business. You don't necessarily have the time to do that. So if you put a technical expert in that can answer their questions, keep them from having to go to reinvent the wheel. So solving the same question that we already know how to help them solve because of our past work, well, that just helps them come along to recognize the value chain. If you leave it to them and say, look, someday we'll try soft white, but that might be 10 years from now. And the only reason that they aren't trying it might be a question that we already know the answer to. So why not give them the answer, help them along, show them why it makes a difference, how it can deliver value to them, and get them to take that step a little bit sooner. That's, in essence, that's the technical part of customer service. Why is the value proposition for SoftWhite something that they should consider?
What is your priority as CEO of the Oregon Wheat Commission? And, of course, also, is your title CEO of the Oregon Wheat Growers League as well?
It is.
What's your top three priorities?
I guess this is how I'd answer that. The survival issues, you want to call it the crisis of the day, is always part of the deal. You've got to take care of those. When the GE wheat thing was going on, it took priority over everything else. So there's always something, the farm bill, whatever is the highest priority, you got to attend to those things. The flip side of that, and I really think it is a major part of the job, is I've got to figure out and sort out what I don't do. You only have so many hours, and sometimes you just look at something and go, life as we know it will go on if I don't get to that one. So some of the art is deciding which ones get your time and which ones you're going to ignore. We just don't have the staff and the resources to do everything.
Give me an example of something that you ignore.
Oh, I shouldn't do that because then people would know I'm ignoring it, Scott.
Well played.
Maybe the third area is helping the growers, whether it's commissioners or the league board. So when does an issue become big enough? So some issues start at the local level, and the growers handle them right up to a point where, wait a minute, this one's now moving into an arena or a level or an intensity that, as staff, I need to come alongside, and we need to start working this one together. Part of it is keeping track of what's going on and knowing when that time is. And sort of related to that, this is one of the tougher parts of the job, is sometimes you have to look at your board, for instance, in the league board, and help them understand when their expectations are too high. You can tell me as the CEO, we want you to go get a revision to the Endangered Species Act, right? Gentlemen, that is probably not in the realm of things that we can do. So you have to help them manage in the policy arena what you can and can't do, what's a stretch, where are you're you can want it, but it's either not the job of the Wheat League or this is something that fundamentally you can't do. And nobody likes to hear those, but that's part of the job, is to help them manage the expectations about what can and can't be done.
In Washington, we're really pushing quality as our ace in the hole in terms of markets. Do you agree? And what is Oregon's philosophy when it comes to quality, and how are you communicating quality to your growers?
I don't think there's any difference in the focus that we put on quality. As a matter of fact, I think the three states have done a really good job of being together about the importance of quality. It's a consistent message. I think we work it just like my counterparts in Washington and Idaho. That's an important piece of communication to our growers. That it's not just the growers. I mean, we try to be consistent when we talk with the trade. We talk with the exporters and the handlers. We talk with our breeding programs. We talk with our customers. It's across the board. And the one thing, like, as a for instance, we always tell our breeding program is, I don't want to see two varieties where growers have to choose between quality and yield. Bring me two varieties where they get yield and quality, because it's not, don't put the growers in a position where they're having to pick between quality bushels and more bushels. That's unfair. It's unreasonable. And I think the growers are on board. So they want us to bring them varieties that will do both things. Don't make us choose between quality and yield. That's a bad spot to be in.
Of course, I'm more familiar with the legislature in Washington than I am in Oregon. Is the way that agriculture is treated in Oregon similar to the way that agriculture is treated in Washington, or are the legislators in Oregon still closer to agriculture?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think we suffer some of the same things, is that the rural influence, the agricultural natural resource influence in the legislature is less than it was. And you know, issue after issue, that it becomes harder and harder to hold the perspectives or what's best, in our view, what's best for ag, delivering that through the legislature. It's getting tougher and tougher to do. That goes back to some of that social license and whether people trust us as stewards of the land, and those are just challenging things. The view of science, how the population judges what's good and bad science has changed, certainly over my career. So, yeah, I don't think it's all that different, even though sometimes we like to think we have it worse than than anybody else. But, no, I think Oregon, Washington, California, we all face some pretty tough legislative sledding.
Most podcasts don't come so neatly full circle, but the social license Roe talked about at the top of the episode goes directly to the wheat industry's strength, or lack thereof, in the Oregon legislature. More farm consolidation is inevitable, but as that consolidation occurs, the wheat industry needs to be aware of the truism that talks about strength being in numbers. Before I close, a quick reminder. This podcast is being released July 17th, 2018, and harvest is quickly gearing up across vast swaths of the region. As I have said in the past, I am beholden to you, my listeners, my seed wheat. It is from you that I see this podcast being planted in the minds of many, reaping a great harvest of listeners. Give friends, family, and employees this harvest something to listen to that also gives them something to think about. Most everyone has a smartphone nowadays. Give the gift of Wheat All About It to those hard-working harvest crews. Thanks for listening, and please join me again next week for another episode of Wheat All About It!
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our belly. History of starvation in times of wanting woe. Wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.